Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Our show for this week will be a bit different than our normal fare in that we will be featuring a debate between three scholars on the question of whether or not the United States would benefit from a Christian democratic political party, similar to the ones that were developed in Europe in the 19th century and which, to varying degrees, still exist in a number of countries out there to today. This debate is similar in structure to the one that we did on the question of whether or not Christians should have fought in the American Revolutionary War that we aired a few years ago. We will give each scholar roughly 20 minutes to make their case separately, and then let you, the dedicated listener, decide and reply to who has the most convincing case. This structure is a bit different than the panel discussions we featured from the Religious Freedom Project, such as the one from last week on religious extremism. There we had all the scholars mic'd up in one room, and that made cross-discussion much easier. Our telephony technology, though, on this podcast does not allow for an easy recording of conference calls, hence all our guests are recorded in isolation from one another. They do know one another, however, and the topic for today was actually pulled from a symposium project that brought together many different scholars to debate the efficacy of Christian democratic parties in the United States. That symposium was published in the journal Perspectives on Political Science in the winter of 2017. We'll put up a link to that journal for listeners to check it out. Professor Hunter Baker was the special editor of that issue, and he will be our first guest. Other contributors included Paul Bonicelli, Jordan Ballour, Paul Miller, David Koizis, Brian McGraw, and Micah Watson. Those latter two authors will be our guests following Hunter Baker. I should also note that I, your fuzzy host, appeared in that symposium as well, and will have some concluding thoughts about my perspective on the issue of Christian democracy at the end of the podcast, so be sure to listen all the way through. And you can request a copy of my article over on our Facebook and Twitter pages, so mosey on over there, and we'll see if we can make the other scholars' papers available too. We will introduce each scholar more fully as they appear in today's forum, but suffice it to say that our guests in order of appearance are, first, Hunter Baker, an associate professor of political science at Union University, who will take the pro-Christian democracy stance; Brian McGraw, an associate professor of politics at Wheaton College, who will defend the firm but undecidedly squishy middle ground; and Micah Watson, an associate professor of political science at Calvin College, who is opposed to the whole concept of Christian democracy in America. Links to their bios will be found on our website, so please do check it out at www.researchonreligion.org. Okay, so let's start it off with Professor Hunter Baker, a guest who has appeared on our show several times in the past, discussing issues such as secularization and religious higher education. As noted, he is an associate professor of political science at Union University and author of three books: The End of Secularism, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, and The System Has a Soul. He was the recipient of the 2011 Michael Novak Award conferred by the Acton Institute and has lectured widely on religion and liberty. In addition to his work at Union, Professor Baker holds a law degree and serves as an associate editor for the Journal of Markets and Morality, and a contributing editor for Touchstone, a journal of mere Christianity. He is also a research fellow at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Hunter, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Happy to be with you again.
So, first off, you were the wrangler who brought a herd of scholars together to debate whether the United States needs a Christian Democratic Party. What was the rationale and genesis of that project?
Yeah, well, obviously we've been through a pretty strange political season in the past year or so, and I just was watching all these debates, you know, especially on the Republican side, and I thought, you know, on the one hand, we had Donald Trump as the front runner, you know, virtually throughout, and he was selling essentially economic nationalism. I was listening to the other candidates, and they had kind of the standard Republican line that I sense is seems to be losing appeal in America. And I just kind of started to wonder, is there some way to break through this alignment of things that I see? Now, you know, it has turned out that Donald Trump is the one who broke through the alignment of things and seems to be kind of recreating American politics and coalitions. But that's not necessarily satisfactory to me. I suspect that it's not necessarily satisfactory to many Christians that there may be some other constellation of policies that they would prefer to see. And so I wondered, you know, so what is another model that we could be looking at? And so as I thought about it, I thought about, you know, what would work with a Christian faith? And I thought, well, look, you know, what is a very successful movement, certainly in Europe? I mean, largest party in the European Parliament, the party that has governed Germany for, you know, the great majority of the time since World War II, Christian democracy. And so, you know, you look at something like the German version of Christian democracy, it emerges after World War II to try to pick up the pieces, right? You know, Germany is in ruins. Germany has lost. Germany is divided in half with the Soviets owning half of it, including half of Berlin. And this Christian Democratic Party locates the central political problem, you know, why they are where they are, in materialism and secularism. And I think that's similar to the diagnosis that many American Christians would have. And, you know, who is influential in that movement? Well, you could think of somebody like, you know, Röpke, the economist, wrote the Wilhelm Röpke, A Humane Economy. You know, he has this vision for freedom, and, you know, he's one of kind of the architects of the economy. It's kind of a miracle in Western Germany after the war. Has a vision for freedom, but also for human flourishing beyond kind of Homo economicus. You could think about Augustine. You could think about Kuyper. This emphasis on governing for concord, governing for harmony. You know, the effort is to try to find ways to mediate between the rich and the poor. I mean, obviously, you know, we hear almost an obsessive discussion of inequality and social justice and redistribution. Christian democracy addresses itself to that to some degree, trying to protect the rich and the poor from each other, trying to align interests, trying to point out certain things. I mean, Kuyper, for instance, pointed out that regulation can be predatory on the poor and serve the interests of the rich, right? So, you know, trying to kind of have some of these insights. You think back to somebody like Aristotle. Aristotle says that all constitutions, you know, there's lots of constitutions, but basically they all end up being either democracy or oligarchy. And when he says democracy, he's very clear that what he really means is the rule of the poor. And when he says oligarchy, he means the rule of the rich. Neither of these are super desirable, and Christian democracy is sort of a self-conscious attempt to fight that. And you know, maybe finally, the final point here about the genesis of the idea is that I have a practical interest in terms of trying to find a way to unite a broader coalition of Christians. You know, I mean, do you, if you're somebody like me who is a limited government, free market type guy, is there some value in accepting maybe a little bit different angle on economics in an attempt to gain more help on cultural issues or more protection from what I see as secular aggression from the left? And I think that when I talk to Christian friends who tend, you know, the ones who vote on the left, they are attracted by an alternative of that type. And so, you know, maybe there's some protection in that kind of alternative party organization.
So how did you end up bringing together a group of scholars and get it published in this journal, Perspectives on Political Science?
You know, well, I guess there's a couple of things there. First of all, I knew Peter Lawler a little bit, who is the editor of the journal. And so when I first had the thought, I wrote to him and I said, you know, are you interested in this? And it turned out that he was. He thought it was kind of an intriguing idea. And it just so happens that I know people, I know some great Christian scholars, you know, people like Tony Gill and Brian McGraw and Michael Watson, David Koizis and others. And I just thought, you know, maybe I can gather these folks together and get them to reflect on this. I mean, you know, I mean, what do scholars do if not to kind of consider interesting ideas of this type? And the whole thing came together really well, and here we are.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting issue, a special issue of the Perspectives on Political Science, and like I said, we'll connect people back to it. You may need a university subscription to get access to it, but we'll see if we can make some of these articles available to other folks in different ways as well. So connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. With that said, your idea for creating this project based on the tumult of the American political system in the past few years, if not decades, and in bringing together a bunch of scholars, you're the one who takes the strongest position in favor of Christian democracy. So go ahead and make the case for why the U.S. needs a Christian Democratic Party.
Well, I think that's a lot of what I'm trying to say in the answer to the last question. But I think that there is a serious threat. You know, if you want to get down to what is motivating me, at the bottom of it all, my predominant interest has been in religious liberty. I mean, people will say things to you like, well, don't jobs matter more or something like that. Of course, those kinds of things matter, but my view is that if you don't have religious liberty, then you are, in fact, truly unfree. And as I looked at American politics, you know, one of the problems with the Obergefell decision on gay marriage, leave aside just the question of gay marriage good or bad, right? Let's leave that off the table. When the United States Supreme Court turns gay marriage into a constitutional right, that immediately places constitutional law, constitutional rights in the United States at loggerheads with Christian orthodoxy. And so the natural impulse of people is going to be to translate any opposition to gay marriage, even in private or semi-private contexts, into kind of an analog for segregation, right? And so, you know, this gets into questions of hiring policies for Christian schools and universities or nonprofits. You know, there's any number of ways this could work out. But the one possibility would be that Orthodox Christians or traditional Christians could essentially be almost entirely forced out of kind of that third sector of nonprofit tax-exempt activity in the United States. And so then the question is there some way to try to avoid becoming politically homeless? I look at the Republican Party, and, you know, over the past couple of years, you see things like the governor of Georgia, Nathan Deal, for goodness sake, is given a religious liberty bill that would protect these kind of interests that I'm talking about in Georgia, and he vetoes it. Okay, this is a guy elected by conservative Republicans in Georgia. And I started thinking to myself that probably you could have a coalition of corporate interests and Republican politicians that would go in that direction, and then Christians could, in a sense, end up politically homeless in the United States. And I thought that a Christian Democrat Party might be a way to protect those interests. And in fact, I mean, that's what a lot of Christian democracy has been historically. If you look at somebody like Kuiper, what he was doing was trying to resist. I mean, his party was called the Anti-Revolutionary Party, which the revolution he's referring to is the French Revolution, right? He's he's trying to prevent the logic of the French Revolution, that secularizing logic, from taking root in the Netherlands. So that's the kind of thing that I think that has become more of a threat in the United States than it used to be, and so the logic is similar.
So let me ask you a few questions on this. Christian democratic parties in the 19th century and into the earliest 20th century were founded on many of the same reasons, to prevent Christians from becoming politically homeless in an era of democratization. They felt threatened by secularism, either from the French Revolution or from other various forces out there in Europe. But historically speaking, the Christian democratic parties really, I could argue, haven't succeeded in that mission. Europe is more secular than they ever were before. And on top of it, the parties just don't seem to be pushing back as much as they did before. So how would you answer that? Do you think the same thing could be happening in the United States?
Yeah, I would say that that's mostly, that's mostly correct. But I would also say, I mean, for instance, look at Germany. Germany still doesn't have gay marriage. Who would have guessed that Germany, you know, Christian Democrat Germany, would have gay, would still not have gay marriage after the United States did. The Christian Democrats are still standing on that. They have domestic partnerships, but, you know, there is a difference between that and gay marriage. Also, you look at the Christian Democrat position on refugees. now, whether you agree or disagree with that, I think that Angela Merkel's position on refugees is arguably a strong Christian position. Now, is it true that, you know, Western Europe is super secular, despite the fact that it's had Christian Democrat parties? Yes. But I believe that European secularism has a lot to do with the fact of the established churches of Europe. I think that, you know, I kind of follow Rodney Stark in thinking that, that is probably the thing that has innervated the church the most, and that the, you know, probably they've been more effective politically than they have been religiously. Also, I would note that there's a difference between church and state and religion and politics. So I don't think that, that Christian Democrat parties have had a secularizing influence in the same way that the established churches have. Now, look at America. In America, we have a lot of church-state separation, but, you know, pretty broad acceptance of religion and politics. And so, you know, one of my working theories is that maybe the Christian democracy plant would grow better in American soil.
Because of the religion and politics angle. But let me ask you this.
Right.
If you actually create an institutionalized party that is associated with Christians, is there a tendency, do you think, to have Christians then ask for a lot of government subsidies that move more toward creating church and state linkages like in Europe?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought of it from that angle, just because that's not what Americans do. I would say that actually relates to the action of the Republicans and the Democrats in the 1990s and the early 2000s. It seems to me that both parties flirted pretty hard with Christian democracy during that time. You know, Clinton tried to set up the New Democrats, and I think, you know, and for instance, they're the ones who introduced charitable choice, which would open the door to more faith-based participation in government, you know, especially through charity. And then the Republicans with George W. Bush with compassionate conservatism, I think they were both trying to hit that kind of Christian Democrat sweet spot. The subsidy angle, though, I think has sort of failed in American church-state separation, and I think that's fine. I think that's okay. I think it's dangerous. I think that an American Christian Democrat Party would need to not be so much in favor of subsidy. The only place where I could see it would be important is potentially in the area of education. If there is to be a regime of school choice, then you would want the Christian schools to be able to participate in that.
One of the other arguments that you make in your paper relates to what's going on in the Netherlands and something called Dutch pillarization, and you pull from the work of Chris Soper and Steven Mansma on this, and explain what Dutch pillarization is, and then answer my concern with that, which would be, doesn't pillarization lock people into certain identities with government policy and make it very difficult for people to move between different identities?
Yeah, okay. First, the question of what is pillarization? Well, when Kuiper was kind of fighting for the prerogative of parents in their child's education, he was worried that the state would gather all children into one system of education and then be able to promote a secular agenda through that system. Well, I think that was a very reasonable fear. And so his answer to that, you know, is to emphasize something that one scholar has called vertical pluralism or ideological pluralism, the idea that the state should recognize different religious or ideological families operating within the context of the state. And so pillarization is the idea that that if you are, say, let's say you're a Catholic family in the Netherlands, then you will be able to have your children go through a Catholic education that is effectively not only tolerated but essentially sponsored to some degree by the state, and that similar channels are available for other individuals. As to the question of whether you're locked in, I don't know that that's a feature of the system, that you would not be able to change channels essentially if you had a different view. Now, you know, one of the other questions is, okay, are you looking to the state to kind of give you these rights? I greatly prefer that option. I mean, you know, I would rather just have God-given rights and we let people do what they want to do, you know, within certain wide bounds. But I also kind of have to argue in the alternative. If I'm going to live in a government characterized by growing state power that tends to want to expel religious influences, then I need some kind of a weapon or shield to bring to hand. And pillarization seems to offer an opportunity of that type.
Does pillarization, though, tend to lock the ideological divisions within society into a certain static position, because you're all getting rewarded for being a Catholic or being a Protestant or being a Jew or being a secular, and it really kind of demotes the idea of innovation. There could be a lot of people saying, "No, I don't want any of these anymore. I'm going to create something new," but I don't get rewarded for it. So why would I want to take the jump there when the government's providing goodies to everybody?
Yeah, I lost a little bit of the question there, but I think I know what you were saying. And my answer to that is that, you know, I simply agree with you that this is not the best option. It's a second best option, or it's a less worse option. I would prefer the more open and innovative possibility, but I also have to deal with the potential need to defend against aggressive secularism.
Well, speaking about different options, what would be wrong with working within the two-party system that we have here in the United States? One of the fears that many people might have is that if you create a Christian Democratic Party and they're winning elections, everything is great. You have a good defense for your team and you're in power. But then when you lose, it potentially could be taken away or everything scaled back. Compare this to having Christians in both parties, Party A or Party B, Republicans and Democrats, being able to leverage, saying, hey, if you don't give us some of the things that we want, some of the defense that we want, we're going to tip to the other side next time. And that way, both parties have to basically listen to Christians.
Yeah, that would be true. I mean, certainly that argument has been made with regard to, say, African Americans, right? I mean, that if African Americans did not vote so monolithically with the Democrat Party, then they would actually have more leverage in our system, you know, something like that. And, you know, one of the problems from a Christian angle is that the Democratic Party, it seems to me, I mean, I suspect this can be charted pretty easily, is becoming significantly more secular over time, and not only in just kind of a neutral way, but in kind of an aggressive way, such that that party would rate something like religious liberty very low. In fact, might see it simply as discrimination that must be done away with. And so, you know, look, if both parties were, if this was just about economics, for instance, then I think your argument would be very powerful. You know, you have some Christians kind of on the left economically, you have some on the right. I think that would be easy to justify in terms of scripture. You know, I don't think that the Gospels, for example, tell us exactly what economic system we should have. But on issues like the life issue or religious liberty, you know, to me it's not just kind of, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other. So it's not so easy just to be in one or the other party.
Okay. One other question that I have to you involves a corruption scandal. And Brian McGraw in his paper noted that one of the problems with the Italian Christian Democratic Party was that they suffered a pretty significant corruption scandal, and the party basically imploded on themselves. Is it possible that if Christians became locked into one party too closely, and as with all of us, we're all original sinners in respect, and we're all fallen, we fall onto a corruption scandal, could that actually tarnish the reputation of Christianity as well as the politicians?
Yeah, it's a good question. First thing, you know, it gives me a good opportunity for clarification. I don't want to argue that a Christian democracy party in the U.S. would be the Christian party. You know, what I'm trying to put together is a Christian party. You know, obviously not arguing to be the exclusive representative of Christianity in the United States, but simply an opportunity to express political preferences in a certain direction. As far as are there special dangers with a party? I'm not sure that there's a huge difference between having a party and having a movement. I mean, you know, we have a quote-unquote religious right in the United States, or, you know, conservative Christians. We have a pro-life movement. These things are highly visible, if not as visible as a party, very close to being as visible as a party. You know, they can have scandals the same way parties can. Major religious right figures can and have had scandals in the same way. So I'm not sure there's a huge difference. I would say that being a party might actually offer some greater accountability. An activist, I think, has less accountability than an office holder. Formally holding power and having to exercise it might actually introduce some positive sobriety and responsibility.
You're more optimistic about politicians being able to police themselves and citizens being able to police politicians than I am, a topic that I'll turn back to later. But something that you said you're not interested in creating the Christian party, but a Christian party.
Yes.
But doesn't a problem arise in terms of branding? If you brand yourself as the Christian Democratic Party, the term Christian says, well, you either belong to this party or you're not a Christian. I mean, could you say, well, we're just going to have the Evangelical Christian Party, and there will be a Catholic Christian Party, and there will be a, I don't know, a mainline Protestant Christian Party?
Yeah. Yeah, that is something that, you know, we actually argued about this. We did have a debate over this in another podcast with the Acton Institute. And, you know, I think it's fairly easy to settle, which is that maybe you just don't use the formal branding of Christian. I mean, and of course, the very small and nascent American party that exists, the American Solidarity Party, has done exactly that. They originally tried to start as the Christian Democrat Party, and then they decided that, for exactly the reasons that you just elucidated, that they should be the American Solidarity Party instead.
That is the first mention I've ever heard of that party, so the whole project doesn't seem to be going very well.
It's very, very new.
Okay,
very new.
All right, we'll see how that actually turns out in the long run. But as our time comes to an end, do you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to make in terms of supporting the idea of a Christian Democratic Party here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I would say this. I would say that change is possible. You know, our two-party system obviously works pretty hard against the idea of any new influence. You know, the most obvious is that they tend to co-opt any new option. But if Donald Trump has shown anything, he has shown that it is possible to bring in a, you know, almost a totally different coalition, very different interests. He has significantly disrupted the Republican Party, has accomplished almost what you might call a hostile takeover, which is an appropriate term given kind of his location as an 80s type guy when that phrase became popular. But I think that Christians in American politics, I think they've been kind of cast out of the Democrat Party, but if they rely exclusively on the Republican Party to represent them, I think that they're in great danger of being politically homeless, as I said before. And so I don't think it can hurt at all to explore different options of the type that I've set out.
A case well made for the pro-democracy side. We'll turn next to the squishy middle and then finally end up with a counter to all of those arguments that were already done. Hunter, it's been great having you on Research on Religion. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
My next guest is Professor Brian McGraw, an associate professor and chair of the Department of Politics at Wheaton College. He earned his PhD from Harvard in 2005, where he discovered his interest in the normative and philosophical aspects of politics. In addition to being the overlord of his department at Wheaton, he has also professed at the University of Georgia, University of Notre Dame, and Pepperdine University. Brian is the author of Faith in Politics, Religion and Liberal Political Thought from Cambridge University Press, and is working on a manuscript dealing with pluralism, law, religion, and political theology. He's a first-time guest to our program, and if he does well, perhaps we will invite him back in the future. The pressure is on. Brian, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's good having you here for the first time, and it's interesting having you because you wrote one of the most historically detailed articles in the symposium. And in terms of this debate, you position yourself firmly in the squishy middle ground of, well, maybe we should have Christian democracy, but probably not. So give us your thoughts on the topic. What say you?
Well, yeah, I was invited because of some work I had done in relation to my first book, where I was interested in this normative question about what role religion can and ought to play in pluralist democratic orders. And for the most part, political theorists tend to think that religion, particularly sort of politically organized religion, is a threat to democratic stability and legitimacy and justice. And my book suggests that's not actually quite the case. And I use the histories of these religious parties in the 19th century in places like Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Austria, and such, to suggest that, in fact, politically organized religion might have played an important, even a crucial role in the fact that some of those countries' democratic systems developed and were solidified. So what I suggest is that these religious parties, particularly the 19th and the early part of the 20th century, helped solve what I take to be a kind of perennial problem in democratic politics, a problem that we don't really pay a whole lot of attention to in the United States because we live in such a stable democracy. But that's kind of the problem of trust, right? So when you have an election and your opponent wins, the question that's kind of not so the forefront of our minds, but is oftentimes at the forefront of a lot of other places, is do you really trust your opponent when they take office? Is they're going to give you a chance to run for office again in the next cycle? Or is this going to be a kind of a one man, one vote, one time kind of situation? And this is a particular problem in systems that are beginning to democratize, right, where you have groups that are pretty strongly opposed to one another, and then you begin to have kind of democratic elections, and there's not really kind of a long history or a tradition of exchanging power. There's a sense that, well, you know, we'll give this democracy a try, but if I don't like the outcome, maybe we'll end the democracy. And in the 19th century, in much of Europe, this was a significant problem, and it was a significant problem, especially with regard to religious communities, because there had arisen within, you know, the 1850s, 1860s, a set of relatively secularized elites who were interested in forming cohesive nation states, building markets and such, And they thought of their religious communities, Calvinist and Catholic alike, as obstacles to that. I mean, the most vivid example of this is Germany, where Bismarck, initiated a Kulturkampf in the 1870s as a means of sort of uniting other groups in Germany and kind of bringing the Catholic Church in Germany under his thumb. And so what happens is you have religious communities respond, of course. They don't like their churches being taken away from them or having their schools secularized or having their priests kicked out of the country. And so they begin to organize politically. And what I suggest is that what parties do in this, religious parties in particular, Christian parties in this case, is they don't always do this, but they can help bridge this trust gap so that when you start having elections and the parties and these sort of religious communities start having a kind of a significant amount of voting power, the parties can serve as mediators to make their political opponents trust them, to assure that they're not just going to end the democratic experiment or democratizing experiment. A good example of this is Belgium. So in 1884, there were a set of parliamentary elections, and Belgium was being ruled by a sort of fairly liberal constitution. And the Catholic Party was looking like it was going to win the election. But there was a lot of anxiety on the part of their opponents about whether, in fact, if they won the election, would they essentially rewrite the constitution, kind of make a return to the old throne and altar alliance and whatnot. And what happens is, and he had a section of sort of the Catholic population, that's exactly what they wanted to do, right? They wanted to get rid of the liberal constitution and reestablish the sort of a kind of coercive religious establishment. And what happens is the party, in conjunction with some of the bishops, helped quash that movement and more or less kind of give significant kind of political guarantees to their opponents that they weren't going to upend the constitutional order. And this, I think this is important, right? This is an important element because if in a democracy, different opposite views or opposite sort of groups begin to sort of not trust one another or begin to think the other side might kind of defect, as it were, for the democratic game, then you're really in danger of losing the game altogether. But what's interesting, one of the really interesting things I found in my research was that the parties didn't just have this kind of effect on their opponents, they also had an interesting effect on their own members. One of the fascinating parts about it is that the parties were oftentimes tightly networked with, churches, trade unions, newspapers, voluntary associations and the like. And this kind of cross, sort of thick network of institutions, actually helped the parties, kind of rein in and discipline, their own members so that they helped shape their members' political identities such that their members began to think, well, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Calvinist, I'm whatever. And as part of that identity, as part of that sense of my sense of myself, I think that, yeah, we should more or less be ruled by elections and the rule of law and these kind of these sort of liberal orders. And that's something I just sort of take for granted. Right? I don't think anymore that maybe if a certain set of opponents win, I might just decide to defect from the game. And the interesting example here is France, where, in fact, over the course of the 19th century, there were any number of efforts to found a Christian Democratic Party. There were some Christian Democratic movements, but they never were able to found a party, in part because their sort of secular Republican opponents were very much opposed, and because the French bishops themselves were opposed to it. And the result was that for French Catholics, there was, for very many of them, this sense that they had a choice. They could either be small R Republicans, or they could be Catholic. And this helped, I think, sustain a kind of instability in French Republicanism that really, really sort of persisted through the end of World War II. It really wasn't until the 1950s that I think we would say that French democratic rule was consolidated. And in part, it was consolidated because You know, there was a kind of short-lived, not super successful Christian Democratic Party called the MRP. But that's a case where French Catholics never really had very much of an opportunity to think of themselves, to sort of develop for themselves a sense of their own sense of what it meant to be a democratic citizen in France as a Catholic. Right? These were always divided. I would say finally that these parties were really important for these developing democracies because they helped reshape those emerging democratic systems. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about our contemporary debate in the United States about school choice and about whether, you know, public money should go to these religious schools or not, is that in most other democratic countries, that's not even so much of a debate. It's just part of the natural order. In France, in the Netherlands, in Canada, religious schools get public monies. And in many of those cases, they get public monies because the religious parties were successful. This is particularly true in Europe in the early part of the late 19th, early part of the 20th century, were successful at forcing the institutions to kind of pluralize, right, to accommodate themselves to these parties. Because in many cases, the parties were pretty successful. The Netherlands, they won a majority in 1901, same in Belgium in 1884. The Center Party, the Catholic Party in Germany, was for many years actually the most, the largest party in Germany, although it never was able to sort of cobble together a majority. And it made those institutions or those sort of those communities more pluralist. So I think that there's a good reason to think that religious political parties, a Christian political party, can do a number of things that are very helpful in democratic institutions.
So you make a great case for this, and I'm reading your paper, and it's like, wow, Christian democratic parties, you know, contrary to popular expectations at the time and amongst some scholars today, did a really nice job of stabilizing democracy and providing interest satisfaction for a number of people that say, hey, we want policies A, B, and C. Everything sounds really good. But then in your article, you say, well, you know, U.S. is a lot different today. So why is it different, and why wouldn't Christian democracy necessarily fly in our environment?
Well, I mean, one thing is just, I mean, and this is something you know, and most people, it's sort of an immediate reflection should recognize, is there's just a difference in electoral structure, right? Our electoral structure incentivizes us to sort of create two large kind of catch-all kind of parties, whereas the European democratic systems just develop differently, and they're more parliamentary, and you can have a sort of multiple set of parties, and so it's easier to have a party that is a little more ideologically or morally coherent. So it's sort of just we have a different kind of electoral system that makes it much more difficult. If we had a kind of a more pluralistic sort of parliamentary electoral system, then we probably would have something like a kind of a Christian Democratic Party, I would assume, I would guess. I don't know. Who knows? But the other thing, though, is that Christianity is a lot more divided in the U.S. than it is in all these places. I mean, there are something like 20 or 30,000 different kinds of churches, whereas in most of these European countries, you had more or less Catholics, and you had maybe a couple types of Calvinists and some Lutherans, and then a small smattering of others, but there was much less religious diversity, and so you had more potential to kind of cobble together a fairly large group of people who more or less shared a common set of theological and indeed, I mean, kind of political interest. I mean, even if you sort of thought about, okay, if you had a Christian Democratic Party in the United States that tried to bring together, you know, theologically conservative Protestants and Catholics. Well, I mean, you can just at a moment's reflection recognize how many different kinds of people that would be, and how difficult it would be. It would be more like herding cats than it would be like trying to run a political party. And I think too that Christians in the United States are pretty deeply divided, not just theologically, but on really substantive kinds of policy areas, right? So you have, and they're divided in ways that cross-cut. You have people who share theological convictions, but disagree on, you know, should we have higher taxes or lower taxes, more regulation, less regulation, what this kind of foreign policy or that kind of foreign policy. And then you have people who don't agree on theologically, but do agree on these kind of policy areas. And then you have cross-cutting issues of race and ethnicity that matter as well. And I just don't think that it would be plausible to suppose that you could put together enough people who have kind of broad agreement theologically and broad agreement politically to, in fact, be a kind of an effective party. So I think just the practicalities of doing stuff like this make it less plausible.
I was going to say, let me back you up and ask you a question about Christian Democratic parties in Europe historically, because one of their goals, as you mentioned, they help to stabilize democracy, and that's kind of great for everybody in the society.
Right.
But they had programmatic goals, too, of protecting their religion, and to some extent they were successful in
right.
establishing religious schools, funding for religious schools. But over time, how successful was this project? Because if you look at the religious landscape in Europe today, it looks pretty bleh. It's
right.
pretty blasé. You mentioned that the United
Use
States.
A technical term.
Yeah, that's a technical social science term. And there's a lot less innovation. So you mentioned the United States has, you know, so many thousands different types of that.
Right.
But Europe seems to be locked into its a blasé version of what religion was around 1900, give or take a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a good point. I mean, it is the case that, you know, in Germany is probably the best example of this, where because the German government collects a church tax and then distributes it to different sort of recognized churches. It has those churches have an interest in sort of maintaining a particular kind of monopoly, and there is a kind of disincentive, as it were, to innovate. I mean, if you're a church and most of your income comes from resources come from the state, then you don't have as much of a incentive to innovate or to try to meet people where they are. And you probably have an incentive to kind of do whatever it is the state really kind of wants you to do, as well. And certainly the case, the sense that to the degree that these parties were successful in securing public resources for their schools and for themselves, that probably did have an effect at dampening innovation. But it's not, I mean, I will say this, it's not entirely clear to me that was so much the cause of secularization as such in Europe. I mean, the Netherlands is an interesting example of this. Up to the 1960s, the Netherlands was actually it had this weird thing where they were both among the most secular country, in the sense that they had the highest percentage of people who didn't claim any religious affiliation, and the most religious. And then somehow, for some reason, over the course of the 60s, the religious part, particularly amongst Catholics, that just collapsed. And, you know, it's not clear to me that it was so much the kind of the way in which the church and the churches and the state interacted, but rather it was the church's own kind of liberalization, right? The Dutch Catholic bishops, for instance, were kind of at the forefront of liberal theology. In the 1960s, there's a particular sort of very famous bishop who went on TV, and he had a show, and he would say things that the church shouldn't really care much about what people were doing in the bedroom, and wasn't all that concerned whether you came to church or not. And you know, lots of people decided to take him at his word, and just decided to stop showing up. So there are some internal dynamics there that I think matter. I think one of the things that's important to note, though, as well, is that, you know, these churches, these religious parties were founded because of what they saw as threats to their particular religious communities, right? Where the liberalizing or the secularizing elites in the 19th century were very self-consciously attempting to find ways to liberalize these communities, right? And mostly through education, secularizing schools and whatnot. And so these communities pushed back, and many times pushed back quite effectively. But once you push back effectively on that, right, once you more or less, you know, in many places, sort of secured equal rights for religious schools. You know, Catholics are no longer discriminated against in public jobs in Germany and so on. Then the sort of the impetus for having a distinctively religious party seems to fade a bit, right? It's not so clear you actually need that particular party. Once, you know, Catholics are more or less like everyone else, except for the fact they're Catholic, well, then why do you exactly need a Catholic party? And particularly in the post-war era, when, you know, the like Germany, for instance, the social market is largely designed by Catholics, meant to sort of mimic Catholic social thought, for better or worse. Again, what exactly is the kind of the impetus that makes you want to have a Catholic party? And I think it's one of the things that in the United States as well, you know, in as much as many Christian institutions sort of feel themselves under political pressure, we're not, you know, Christians aren't exactly a besieged minority. They sometimes feel that way, but it's less that way. So I think that's part of the reason as well why a Christian party isn't, I think, exactly in the offing.
That's the question I want to lead with here, and this will be one of our last questions, and it comes from Hunter Baker's previous discussion on trying to justify the Christian Democratic Party here in the United States. Hunter argued that the landscape today is much different than it was maybe 50 years ago, and Christians do feel themselves besieged in a number of different areas. He's most concerned about religious liberty and thought that a Christian party would be best to really be a bulwark against assaults on Christian liberty. And he mentioned a number of different cases, the Obergefell decision and Hobby Lobby, although that turned out well for Hobby Lobby. But you can see a number of court cases coming down the pipeline in this regard. Are we living in a new environment, a more aggressively secular environment, where a Christian Democratic Party might be needed or potentially could arise?
Well, I think it's potential, sure. I mean, I think it depends on how kind of the political winds, you know, shift. And you know, I think Hunter is right to see that there are certainly institutions and organizations in American life that would like to sort of, you know, marginalize the church, sort of push it to the boundaries, or even sort of transform it, and it's kind of in their own image, as it were. The difficulty in trying to think about how a Christian Democratic Party might push back against those things is trying to think about what it is, if parties sort of select candidates, they run candidates, they have sort of their groupings within legislatures, they don't just do religious liberty stuff, right? They also do tax and regulation, they do foreign policy, they do all the whole gamut of political issues. And the question is, you know, are there enough people who, you know, are interested in the kind of religious liberty questions who also agree on enough of these other areas where they can be a kind of coherent political party? I'm not so sure that that's the case. I think that we disagree on a lot of other things, it's not clear to me that we actually hold things together. I will say this, though, that one of the things that I think this last election cycle has suggested is that to the degree that people think that their religious beliefs matter politically, that is to say that sort of they help frame what they take to be important, what kind of policy choices they want to see put into practice. One of the things that sort of the lessons, one of the things that I've learned, or I think I've learned from the sort of the history of the Christian Democratic Parties, is that it's better for people to be organized than to be just sort of free-floating voters. That is to say, it's better for people to kind of be a part of political organizations that are meant to press on policy issues, precisely because it helps those people be kind of disciplined. It helps them sort of not simply act on the basis of bad information or, well, as they say, alternative facts these days. And so I suspect, this is what I suspect we will see going forward, is not so much the formation of a Christian Democratic Party, but the formation of what we might think of, or the reformation as we might think of, is kind of as para-parties. That is to say, they're sort of like Christian Democratic parties, but they don't act as parties as such, but rather they're sort of secondary parties that might endorse candidates, put forth platforms, offer support to parties, but only in sort of, you know, insofar as those parties or those candidates agree with whatever this kind of para-party does. So the American Solidarity Party, for instance, which is a kind of Christian Democratic Party in the United States, is probably not going to become a real live and an influential party. But it has the potential of affecting, you know, local elections, state elections, or individual sort of congressional elections to the degree that it can act as this kind of sort of para-party organization. So you might get some of the benefits of a kind of a these sort of Christian Democratic parties without necessarily having them be a party as such. Because I just think the electoral incentives are such that it's going to be really, really quite tough to do.
Yeah, that is an interesting insight that these para-parties, and this is the second time during this podcast I've heard of the American Solidarity Party, and I haven't heard about it until just today. It's very interesting. But that these para-parties are really kind of political movements, and that they can act in many ways as swing voters to work within the two-party system to not necessarily make it the pluralistic party system that they have in Europe, but give it somewhat of a similar vibe in electoral competition.
Yeah, that's possible. Possible.
Well, very interesting insights from Professor Brian McGraw from Wheaton College. Brian, it's been a delight having you on Research on Religion, and we will have to have you back at some point in time. So thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks very much. I'm glad I passed the test.
Our final guest is Professor Micah Watson, a native of California who is happy the Rams are back in Los Angeles and who earned an MA at Baylor University and then went on to complete his doctorate at Princeton. This journey took him increasingly east and away from his beloved West Coast home. But his employment journey is moving him back in a westward direction as he held a position at Union University in Tennessee and is now at Calvin College in Michigan, where he holds the Spolhoff Chair. It should be noted that Grand Rapids, Michigan is slightly east of Jackson, Tennessee, so there is a little bit of backsliding towards the east, but you know, maybe someday he'll make it back out west. Micah has co-authored a number of articles on political philosophy and is also the co-editor with Jesse Covington and Brian McGraw of Natural Law and Evangelical Political Thought. And he also co-authored a book with Justin Dyer entitled C.S. Lewis on Politics and the Natural Law, which just came out with Cambridge University Press last fall. That was a topic that he discussed with us on a previous podcast. We'll link back up to that interview and lots of other goodies on our website, so please do check us out. Micah, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
You start off your critique of Christian democracy in the United States in the same manner that Hunter Baker does, which is rather interesting. You note a growing dissatisfaction by the citizenry in general and Christians in particular with our current political climate, and then also the partisan options that we are more or less left with. You ruminate whether or not a third party might just be the medicine for what ails us, but you conclude that it would not be. So tell us, why is a Christian Democratic Party a bad idea for the United States?
Yeah, so I approach the issue a little bit of a different take. I ask first why it would be bad for Christians, coming at it as a Christian political theorist, just like a feminist might look at something as a feminist, or you know, a Buddhist scholar would look at what might be bad for Buddhists. And I think it's problematic for Christians. I also think it's problematic for the United States generally, both because a proportion of American citizens are Christians. If something's bad for them, then it's going to be bad for the country. But also because I think that it's going to lead to more divisiveness. It's going to lead to more bad politics and more bad religion. There are a number of reasons why I think it's problematic for Christians. One is I don't know how a Christian party is going to organize itself around principles that are uniquely Christian. Most aspects of Christianity that would be translated into political action or can also be affirmed by people who are not Christians. So I think that's part of the problem. I also think that from a Christian perspective, there's a very, there's a lot of, respect for using God's name to use God's name You have to meet a really high burden. It's true in the Jewish and the Christian religious traditions. And so I am really wary about attaching the name of Christ to what have to be rather mundane political projects and proposed legislative acts. I think that that's a pretty tough bar to beat. And in fact, there are warnings and commandments not to use God's name in an unworthy way. So for me, the burden is really high as to why you think that one would think that a Christian political party would be a good idea.
Now, wait a minute. Are you saying here that I shouldn't be praying to God that they're going to fix the potholes in front of my home on the street there? And if I don't, I can condemn everybody to the seventh circle of hell?
No, and having moved to West Michigan, where I saw a Prius get lost in a pothole on the work today, I definitely think prayer for potholes is quite fine. I don't think Christians have a unique insight, however, into the ill of potholes nor the good of good roads. I think that's a common grace sort of thing, as we like to say up here, that everybody can appreciate that. So we really don't get any mileage out of attaching that priority to the name of Christ.
Okay, that's fair enough. What other reasons might it be a bad idea that a Christian Democratic Party coming to America is not good?
Well, I wonder about how it would be composed. You know, a Christian political party has to have boundaries, who belongs and who doesn't. And from the, you know, again, from the Christian perspective, unity as Christians is a particularly important goal. And so if you're looking at a party that's going to include Christians, then you're looking at take the completely Orthodox, mainly African-American denominations, but most African-Americans tend to identify with the Democratic Party. They have views about government involvement in the economy. They have views about various things that are at odds with many white evangelicals who have different views on the market or different views on government intervention. What is it that's going to unify them politically such that they are both advocating for the same principles? There might be some things here or there, but I suspect you're not going to have a party with a big enough tent to include both those types of Christians, which tells me that it's really not a Christian political party that's being sought after, but a political party that is willing to mobilize using religious identities, but is going to exclude some fellow believers based on political principles. Well, in other words, what it tells me is that the real work that's being done is political as a political identity more so than a faith identity.
Now, one of the things that we brought up with two previous scholars, Brian and Hunter, was that when you create a Christian Democrat Party, it does tend to brand things. And this is one of your critiques here. But when I pressed them on that issue, they had said, well, you don't have to put the name Christian there. In fact, there's this party called the American Solidarity Party that is based upon Christian principles. It doesn't have that branding, but it's dedicated to a consistent set of policies that pushed back on some of the increasingly aggressive secularization that Hunter and others see happening. Is that a solution to your problem? Would you be happy with that?
I would be happier with that, but I think it somewhat undercuts the rationale that some are offering for a Christian Democratic Party, particularly when they point to Europe and Latin America and some of these other parties that have used the name of Christ. So, I mean, a religious party, part of what makes them the religious party is they use specific religious identities to mobilize. What you're referencing, what my colleagues, good friends of mine, are referencing, is the content or the vision for what these parties are going to be advocating for. And I think that's fine. But if those policies are grounded in sound political beliefs and morals and that sort of thing, then you can make the case for those based on those things themselves. When you use the name of Christ, then you're doing something different. So, yeah, I think that does help. But then I wonder, what's all the fuss about a Christian Democratic Party? Why isn't this just a different sort of conservative party, or a socially conservative but fiscally moderate party or something like that?
The other question that I raised with them, too, and this might feed into some of what you're talking about, is the difference between a party and a movement. Why not keep these issues of trying to push back increasing secularization or aggressive secularization and push those to the two parties that are already pre-existing? It might give you more leverage.
Yeah, and I think that's a very sound point. I think the frustration that both Hunter and I acknowledge in our opening is that just hasn't seemed to work. It's been done so poorly. I take that as evidence that if the people that are so unhappy with the Republican Party now have been unable to use that as a vehicle for their concerns, what makes them think they're going to be able to start and craft a viable political party that's going to be able to challenge the Democratic and Republican parties? In other words, if you can't steer one of the two parties, what makes you think you have the chops or at least the background and the resources to start a whole new party that's going to challenge the three? So, yeah, I think it's not an either or between movements and parties, but I do think it's a matter of being wise about the sort of marketing, and that anytime we invoke, you know, again, the name of God as part of our marketing of who we are, I find that very troubling.
One of the other critiques that you made was that parties make laws and that laws require coercion. Why is this a problem for Christian democracy in America? It seems like Christian Democrats would be a lot less coercive and a lot less fuzzy, or more fuzzy.
Yeah, sure. You know, the difference between an interest group and a political party is the political party seeks to govern, and parties that govern have to come up with platforms. And platforms, if they're successful, if the hypothetical Christian political party candidates are successful, they'll get into office and then implement their visions. They will have to have positions on all these different things. And every law that gets passed at some level is going to be enforced by coercive measures. So my concern there again is that you are proposing policies in the name of Christ that will be backed up with the power of the state. And here I'm following, you know, the English philosopher John Locke, who says, where in Scripture does Christ give that permission in his name to propose and then enforce laws with the power of the state? I just don't see it. And we have some, you know, pretty good evidence that has been done in the past and hasn't exactly gone swimmingly.
Such as?
In terms of the Christians wielding political force and using it unjustly?
Yeah.
Well, I think in Locke's day, enforcing certain theological beliefs, 5 years before Locke died, they hung a 19-year-old Scottish college student for denying the Trinity. I'd say that's was unjust. I'm not thinking that's going to happen anytime soon, and I know that's not what my colleagues have in mind with Christian Democratic parties. But I do think we have a pretty good history. There's a reason Democratic liberalism took off. Which isn't to say that we have these dark Middle Ages. That's a myth as well. But I think there have been a great number of injustices when Christians have mistaken their theological mandate to spread the good news with a political mandate to enforce the good news and enforce Christian moral behavior.
Now, one of the other things that comes up, too, when we talk about Christian Democratic Party is that it's Christian is a pretty broad tent term, especially here in the United States. And I think it was Brian earlier in the podcast pointed out that we have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of different flavors of Christianity here in the United States. How would that be a problem for Christian democracy?
Well, I think that's a scandal in one sense, right? Jesus prayed that we all might be one. And we've done a pretty bad job of that. And I think this sort of thing heightens and deepens, widens every superlative you like, that scandal, because we will be associating our faith identity with particular political projects. And so I think that when we meet when Christians meet brothers and sisters, and we have enough, you know, to overcome as far as differences as it is, without then adding, oh, you were on this or that side of this political debate. So I just think it's also just functionally quite difficult. As I said earlier, I don't know what kind of platform you have that's going to attract Christians as Christians, which is, to be somewhat polemical, I think this is why my colleagues have suggested that you don't need the name Christ in there. That's why you can go with the American Solidarity Party, which, as far as I'm concerned, it kind of gives up the point.
Yeah. Well, let me push back a little bit on a point that Hunter was making specifically, is that Christians have tried civic organizations for a while and, you know, lobbying groups and different types of social movements. But it seems that, especially in this day and age, with an increasing number of nuns and all these different court cases that Hunter brought up earlier, that Christians seem to be consistently losing the battle. Secular culture seems to be winning. So maybe that strategy is not working. Maybe we do need to have some political oomph behind Christianity, and it's time to grab the reins of power. How would you respond to that?
Yes, if we could just grab the one ring to rule them all. So I understand the frustration, but I think that that solution assumes that the reason that we have lost cultural influence has been because somehow we didn't have the right political power in the first place. The most radical growth of Christian civilization and influence was the first 300 years of the church, and it started off with zero political influence, and it was the witness of the actual Christians living their lives and witnessing to the faith that turned the Roman Empire upside down. Now, I do believe Christians need to be involved in politics. I'm not saying that, but the idea that what would cure our cultural malaise would be Christians holding political power, I find to be completely backwards. I think we do need to engage in politics, but our version of winning is not measured by political outcomes, right? We have a long-term view, and there is no guarantee that the country that we live in will reflect our beliefs. We are a nation apart, even that while we can have a legitimate secondary identity as Americans. So, I mean, that's my quick take on it, my kind of theory take on it. But I also wouldn't want to leave out that you've also addressed this and be curious as to what you think about how plausible this is.
Yeah, I agree with a number of your points here as well. And when I was asked to do this as part of the symposium, I immediately says, Christian Democrat Party, no. I hear some of Brian's points that they were helpful in the 19th century to stabilize and consolidate democracy in some countries. So, yeah, I hear that. But I think the long-term project, as you said, the long-term project is really not in the favor of Christianity here. I come up from it in a very different angle. I'm a political economist by training, and so I use public choice theory, which basically applies economic principles to the political process. And it assumes that individuals within the political process are as self-interested as anybody within the private sphere. So a banker has self-interest to make profit. A politician has self-interest, not necessarily for profit, but to get reelected and to remain in power so that they can make policies that they may favor. And public choice theory, it generates a number of different findings that I think are important in this debate about Christian democracy. The first is that finding the common good is a rather Quixotic type of endeavor. There's some things that I think we as a nation or as humanity can all agree on, that murder is bad and you don't want that kind of mayhem. But once you start moving away from that, as we mentioned with potholes, there's going to be differences on policy, how much social welfare spending is adequate, how much control of the monetary system is adequate, foreign policy issues, all these kind of things are going to divide up people. And then whenever you actually have a party opting for one policy over the other, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And quite naturally, it's human nature that the losers are going to be very upset about the outcome. And if you attach the word Christian to this party and to the policies that they make, the people who are upset with the policies are probably going to become very upset with Christianity as well. And that's very similar to what you're saying. You say it in a much more philosophical and theological sense. I'm just saying that people look at the Christian Democrat Party and say, hey, wait a minute, you're not generating jobs. These policies that you're doing are sending jobs overseas, or they're causing foreign wars that I don't really like. So it's not just the party, it's Christianity that might be the problem. And I think that undercuts the long-term Great Commission of Christianity, if you're trying to really work toward a greater free will understanding of Christianity for the long run. I think that's an important part. The other thing that public choice theory brings up as well is that there's something known as rational ignorance in the political realm. And that sounds really bad. Nobody should be ignorant. But all it's saying is that we can't possibly know everything. And it's not in our interest to research every single possible issue as voters, as well as politicians. And this opens the door to what we call special interest politics or interest group politics. And in the public choice realm, we talk about this in terms of rent seeking. Is that concentrated benefits that accrue to certain groups, they can diffuse the cost to everybody else, and they're able to get policies enacted in the legislature that benefit them and may distribute the cost to everybody else. And then a lot of people look at that and say, oh, that's corruption. And this is a natural part of the political process, of any democratic political process. There will always be special interest groups. And again, if that starts looking like corruption, or if it does become flat out corruption, we are flawed individuals after all. You associate that with a Christian Democratic Party. It's not just the party that takes the hit. It could be Christianity. And I make the argument as well that anytime the party fails, it also reflects very poorly on Christianity. And I think that Christianity could best be served by stepping outside of the political process, being engaged in the process, but understanding that, hey, you know, here's the one policies that we think are very important. Other things might not be that important. We'll let you sort those kind of things out, but we're here for the long haul to really serve the kingdom. A lot of that jives with what you're talking about, and I want to finish off with another part of your paper that I thought was really spectacular. You said, well, given this mess that Christian democracy is not really good, but you know, Christians need to have a say within the political sphere, you bring up Jacques Martin and C.S. Lewis as people who really kind of suggest some alternatives. So why don't you leave us off with that?
Yeah, sure. So Lewis writes an essay called A Meditation on the Third Commandment. And in that, he borrows pretty heavily from Martin. And Lewis, I mean, I'm really following Lewis, and I think actually dovetailing quite nicely with your approach in that it's the association that's going to be problematic. And so Lewis suggests something that he calls the Christian Voter Society, and this would be a group of Christians who commit to a list of political principles, and they would basically say to the political parties, look, if you want our support, this is our platform, and you need to come to us to get our support. So to the extent that you follow this, don't violate these principles, and you can imagine, we can think about what some of these would be, then you will have our support, and if you don't, then we will vote for someone else. And what this does, it protects the name of the church, because the politicians are then coming to the citizens who are Christians, although it'd be tremendously difficult, right, because you'd have to figure out what principles go on there, who's going to join, you know, who would be attracted to it. Lewis went so far as to say that as an Anglican, he would think this would be something would be required, and that for him, he's a pretty libertarian guy, was a huge statement. But I think in principle that something like that would be an interesting project to pursue. The Manhattan Declaration was maybe an early form of that or something about that, about talking about religious freedom and life and marriage. You need something more comprehensive. But what I think is most interesting about that is I immediately think of all the objections, how this would be so hard, and how it would be difficult to get a coalition to coalesce around a statement like this. And if that's hard, if that seems unrealistic, how much harder then to create a party that could not only have those principles, but then try and enforce them through law. So in one sense, the experiment, the idea does double duty. It points to a possible constructive way that Christians can still be involved in politics while keeping their first identity as Christians in the church. But it also acts as a sort of a foil for the Christian Democratic Party, because we can imagine how hard this would be. How much harder would it be to do that sort of thing, but also link that to an operative political party that's going to use coercive measures?
And it does seem that, in part, what Lewis was talking about has occurred at various points in time. You could point to perhaps the moral majority, or even go back deeper in history with abolitionist societies and some of the progressive movements, progressive Christian movements back in the early 1900s as evidence of this kind of thing. But the neat thing about Lewis's solution is that it can be relatively flexible and adjust to conditions at any point in time and allow for potentially wider coalitions, because it does not need to be just a Christian Democratic Party or a Christian Democratic movement, but you can draw in Jews and Muslims and Buddhists, and many times some secular humanists might even be interested in some of the policies that are there, so you can build a broader coalition.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's great. I mean, those historical examples, but then also the flexibility. I mean, think about the change in our politics with regards to the NRA, right? Now, I'm not saying that that position is necessarily the one I'd want a Christian voter society to uphold, but both parties now are very reluctant to cross the NRA. So even on the Democratic Party, which is less hospitable to gun rights, they're very careful about it because they want to do well in West Virginia and in different places. So that a group can have an influence merely by stating its positions and having these kind of scorecards, I think is well documented. You'd want to do it, obviously you'd want to do it very well and very carefully, because again, you'd be using the name of Christ in this case, but you're using the name of Christ to put forward a vision for the political community, as opposed to putting one together for the political community that you then seek to use coercive measures to make happen. But no, I think that's a very helpful point. Wouldn't necessarily have to be Christian, and it has some flexibility built in.
And draws across a lot of different bounds, and also, I think, pulls in a lot of other different issues as they change. Because whereas you might think we shouldn't draw Christ's name in terms of fixing the potholes in front of my house, I don't know. I think I'm at that point. So, but anyways, a very interesting discussion, very interesting read. Again, all of these articles that we've talked about are in Perspectives on Political Science, the Winter 2017 issue, and we will point listeners back to that. And listeners, you all are welcome to chime in, and we invite your comments over at our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And I want to thank all our participants, and including our last one here, Micah Watson. Micah, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.